You're listening to a podcast from 702.
702.
The Naked Scientist.
It's 10 minutes after 10 o'clock. And Chris, good morning to you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, hello, Aubrey.
So I'm told that in 1919, Eddington had a great experiment. Tell us a little bit about this.
The situation was that in 1915, Einstein had finished and published his theory of relativity. What remained was for someone to prove that he was right, because this was maths and it was conjecture. What we needed was some hard evidence. The problem was that in order to do this, you're dealing with a world war, because Britain was at war with Germany. And so the global politics weren't ideal at the time for mass collaborations to test scientific theories. But Arthur Eddington, who was a conscientious objector in World War One and had not taken part, was told, well, if you're not going to fight, then you can go and do a very important science experiment instead. And in 1918, the armistice was declared, and he then was dispatched in 1919 to go to South America, and he went to West Africa, another team went to South America, and the idea was to take a photograph of the total eclipse, because there was a total eclipse which was going to go in a strip across the Earth, just south of the equator, across South America and southern Central Africa. And the reason they wanted to get the picture of this eclipse is that Einstein's prediction was that massive objects like our nearest star, the Sun, would deform the fabric of space in such a way that light travelling nearby would be deflected or bent. This is called gravitational lensing.
Yeah.
And this would have the effect of making stars look like they're in a slightly different place to where they really are. But because the starlight is so dim compared to the sunlight, it's very hard to see that effect, because it's only going to be manifest very close to the Sun itself. In other words, stars that are just on the margin of the Sun. So if you photograph an eclipse, you've then got the opportunity during that one time to see these stars, which are really, really close, and then ask, are they in the wrong position, apparently? So that's what they went and did. And they took these photographs, and they actually prove that the stars are bent off course by about the width of a star when you see it in the sky. So a very tiny amount, but it's enough to prove that Einstein's theory had legs, because prior to that, everyone thought that it was what Newton had said for a couple of hundred years, and that was the way that maths and physics worked. And this upstart Einstein, who was proposing an entirely new way of thinking about the universe, people initially didn't really understand it, and they didn't really appreciate why it was so important. And once they had this experiment in their hands, and it was done successfully, and luckily, they thought in the morning, when there was a thunderstorm in West Africa, very unseasonal at the time, they thought the whole thing was going to be blitzed. They got the pictures, and they made history. And that actually was on the 29th of May, 1919, so it's coming up next week. Very important anniversary.
Well now, Chris, that's quite a mouthful, but I suppose it raises the question about perception and reality, you know. You speak of the way that the light moves through space, and that may change where the stars are positioned as we see them. Does that necessarily mean that the stars are in different positions in reality, or just in perception?
No, the stars aren't moving. I mean, these are stars which are millions and millions of light years away in some cases.
Yeah.
But certainly across some of them are in the distant smudges on the universe. You've got distant galaxies. But the stars in our Milky Way, some of them may be 100,000 light years away. They're very, very remote.
Yeah.
And so you're not talking about anything which is moving, because it doesn't know that there's going to be an eclipse on Earth,
sure,
is it? And so it's actually that the light which is coming through space is encountering gravitationally massive objects. Big objects, which are like black holes and stars, are sufficiently massive that they warp space itself. And so the light follows a curved path, because the space it's passing through has bent. Light always travels in straight lines, but if space is bent, the light has the impression of going round a bend. And that's the effect that was being observed in Eddington's photographs and had been predicted by Einstein.
Suppose that's a story for another day, but it seems to have many deeply philosophical implications, I suppose, for life in many different ways, Chris. But we've got a number of calls on 011-883-0702. Daryl is in Midrand. Hi, Daryl.
Hi.
Yeah, go for it. What is your question for the Naked Scientist?
Dr. Chris, I'd like to know if to know if platelet-rich plasma treatment works or whether it's a hoax. It's been recommended to me by a doctor because I've got an upper hamstring strain, and they reckon if they can withdraw my blood, spin it up, take out the white blood cells, inject them back into my hamstring, that will heal the area.
All right, Chris?
Okay. The rationale behind doing this kind of thing is that there's some evidence that if you inject stem cells, or if you take cells which are, including white blood cells, from tissue, blood, and you put them into another tissue, you can stimulate or do immune modulation and promote some kind of stimulation of healing or repair in that area. This is a very early field. It's not got a huge evidence base behind it, and there's not lots and lots of well-controlled studies on this. So there's not really good, robust, resilient data to support, if you do this, this will happen. The rationale is that you're basically trying to stimulate healing by putting new cells into an area that may be devoid of some cells, and that perhaps it's the trauma of putting the cells in. Perhaps when the cells go in there, you activate them in some way and they secrete some factors that temporarily increase the activity of other cells in the tissue that can encourage healing. It's all a bit hand-wavy at the moment, and I would be cautious. I would ask, before you pay any money and before you subject yourself to any of these sorts of therapies, I would ask to be presented with the peer-reviewed clinical data. Say, where's the medical trial that shows that this works? And then make sure that they can explain that trial to you and why they believe this is the appropriate course of action. Because if they haven't got that data, then they might as well say, well, I'll inject you with water. Because that would be, you know, as good. You need that data to show that what they're proposing to do is supported by decent, rigorously controlled evidence. And if that doesn't exist, then don't do it.
John is an observatory. Hi, John.
Good morning, Aubrey. Good morning to your guests. I need to know, why is it that this time of the year, which is the dry season, whenever I touch something metal or even sometimes shake somebody's hand, there's this static and I get these sparks going. Because this week alone,
yeah, this is quite common.
Seven times.
Yeah. Go ahead, Chris.
It's your electric personality. That's what it is. It is more common in the warm weather. It is more common in the summer. And the reason for this is that people increasingly wear rubber-soled shoes. But shoes are made of leather. It's a poor conductor of electricity. And when you scoot around, you walk around, especially on carpets and things, you end up with some charges being rubbed off of you and some charges being rubbed off the carpet onto you. And because the shoes are an insulator, you can't easily get electricity flowing between the two to balance out the charge disequilibrium. So a person can slowly accumulate a charge over a period of time. And that charge can't leak away. But when you go and shake someone's hand, they'll have a different charge to you, and therefore there's a potential difference, an electrical difference between the two of you, and so a current wants to flow. And that is why you get a shock when you touch the other person, because of that charge disequilibrium. You could do several things. One, you could earth yourself regularly. So if you go and touch something which is connected to the earth electrically, then the current will balance from you to the object, and that means that you'll build less of a charge over time. So although you'll keep getting little shocks, there'll be much less of a shock. The other thing you could do is to not move so much, because it's the actual friction and the movement around that actually causes you to accumulate that. Or you could put yourself on an electrical lead. So plug yourself into an earth and then connect yourself to that, and then every time you accumulate a bit of charge, it'll drain away to earth, but that will have the disadvantage. You'll be on a leash.
Static electricity, Chris. So let's take a break. When we come back, more calls coming through with questions that have to do with science.
702, The Naked Scientist.
Chris Smith, The Naked Science, is still with us. We're taking calls from you and, of course, SMSs and tweets to get a better understanding of some of those mysteries that you see in the natural world. And perhaps Chris can help us understand them. I've got a few calls, Chris, so I'm going to go straight to them. Teddy is in El Dorado Park. Hi, Teddy.
Hi there, how are you, man? Naked Scientist, hello.
Go for it, Teddy. What's your question?
I've one curiosity that I'd like to sort of have answered, please. When this notion that what happens, say, for example, on Earth, I think it's quantum physics, what happens, say, here on Earth is affects what happens billions of light years away on some other place in space. It also relates to, for example, the notion that, you know, what you think is what you are. It kind of extends to that notion.
So what is your question, Teddy?
How do you understand to that? My question is, what is the proof around that theory that, say, what happens here affects what happens billions of light years away?
Chris?
Hello, Teddy. You're referring to something that Einstein actually was somewhat dismissive of at first. He dubbed this spooky action at a distance when quantum physicists came up with the idea of entanglement. This is the idea that an object has in some way got some kind of relationship with its partner, and that even if you separate those objects by millions and millions of light years, they would still have some kind of entangled, interconnected behavior. An example of this is, for example, if you made two light particles, photons, two light waves, and you send them on two different paths, one knows, in inverted commas, what the other one's doing, even though they're now remote from each other. We don't have the foggiest idea how this works, so I can't possibly explain, and certainly not here on the radio in a couple of minutes, how this works, but we might be able to use this usefully. But what it does point to is that there is a lot of those huge rafts of physics that we don't understand yet, and we have no idea how they work, but that's what is at the basis of entanglement. Now, in terms of how our brains work, this is something quite different, because what we're comparing, when we're talking about entanglement, we're talking about things at the quantum level. These are when you shrink things down to the very, very tiny. Now, our brains, on the other hand, are enormous in comparison, because they're made of billions of cells. There's something like 100 billion nerve cells in a brain, and they make thousands of connections between each nerve cell, and the brain processes information by creating circuits where nerve cells pass information on in a neural network. That said, there's no reason why there couldn't be these quantum rules are going to apply in a brain, but at smaller levels. So we're not really going to explain our behavior on the basis of quantum physics, because we're dealing with something which is much bigger than the quantum world with the way a brain works.
All right, let's talk to Convoy in Mamelodi. Hi, Convoy. Convoy? All right, Convoy is still thinking about it. Cynthia is in Sandringham. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, thanks. I saw something which puzzled me very much. I was watching some ants, really tiny ones, trying to get an insect into their hole. Now, I always thought that creatures such tiny ants would all work together. And I noticed that they got hold of this insect, and some were pulling, you know, north, south, and some south, and some were going round. And they actually turned this insect 360 degrees, and they just couldn't seem to agree which way to go now. Must we assume that ants actually have opinions, that they don't all work by instinct? I was quite amazed.
Cynthia, thanks very much for that. And in fact, Chris, I've heard of a biblical verse that says, go down to the ant, thou sluggard, learn their ways and be wise. So perhaps ants can teach us quite a few things.
Hi, Cynthia. Really nice observation. And I wondered this myself as well, because I've watched little teams of ants. Probably the answer to this question, we know that ants have various behaviors that enable them to find the easiest ways and the shortest distances between their nest and where they're going to forage for food. And they use these chemical trails that they lay down to guide themselves between one and the other, and also to tell their nest mates where there are rich sources of food. And as the ants go along these paths, they reinforce them. And what they do to lay a chemical direction, they put chemical arrows into the path. So they make branches in their paths, and the angles that these branches occur at either point towards or away from home. And the ants, using their two antennae, can smell what the direction of those arrows are. So they know the direction of home, and they know the direction of away. So even though they're all working in a big circle around an object, which is far bigger than an individual ant, they can still nonetheless detect where home is and where away from home is. So if they're taking a food item collectively towards home, they should be able to resolve the direction of home and all pull together in the right direction. And the converse is true. It seems to have gone wrong with this insect, though. Perhaps some of the ants that were pulling and being spun round were off of the trail. They'd lost the trail, and so they didn't actually know what the correct way to go was. So it'll take them a little while to orientate themselves before they can all begin to move together again. But what a lovely observation. And if anyone also has got any additional information they could add to this, if there are any entomologists listening, do tell us, because that's a really nice point to have raised.
Siviwe in Boksburg. Go ahead, sir.
Hi,
very good, thanks. Viewer, what is on your mind, sir?
I just wanted to find out about sleep paralysis. We blacks call it... Yeah, when you just sleep and you can't move, but you feel like you're sitting on your chest. Yeah.
Chris, do you have anything to say about sleep paralysis? Yeah.
The answer to this is that when you go to bed at night, your brain deactivates the flow of information from the motor areas of your brain, which generate movements, down your spinal cord, brain called the brain stem. And in there, in one region, is an area called the locus coeruleus. And in a region around that called the subcerulea region, there are clusters of nerve cells whose job it is, when you are actually asleep, to engage this paralysis system. And they gate the flow of outgoing information down the spinal cord. Now, when you have sleep paralysis, what we think is happening is that, just for people who've not experienced this, people will describe that they'll suddenly wake up, but they cannot move. And it's terrifying because you think, I've woken up paralyzed. I'm totally locked in position. And then it goes away. And we think that what's happening is that when you're asleep, this system is in place to stop you acting out your dreams, rolling around violently and falling out of bed. When you suddenly wake up and the brain hasn't had time to prepare to wake you up, there's a delay between this system disengaging and when it should have disengaged. And so there's a short period of time, which is probably exaggerated in our minds because we wake up and we're frightened. So it tends to feel like it lasts longer than it really is. There is this time when you can't move because the paralysis system hasn't been switched off. And when it does then switch off, you're back to normal again. And we think it's down to this region of the brainstem called the subcerulea region. And people have done experiments on cats, actually, where they were able to deactivate this region in a cat. And when the cats they were studying went to sleep, instead of staying restfully in their baskets, the cats would be up and about prancing around, acting out their dreams. Because as they were dreaming, they were trying to do what their dreams were saying they were doing. And that's why you have this region, because if you didn't, then it'd be a pretty violent night in everybody's house at night time.
Chris Smith, thank you very much for joining us, sir, and really appreciate your time.
Thanks, Aubrey. Bye-bye, everyone.